There is no chance that they can change things until Saddam dies, and then presumably there's going to be a crazy power struggle in Iraq. That's true.
And it's my generation who's going to be going off and fighting this war if it does indeed happen.
We were completely open to negotiating other march routes, but the NYPD and the courts are saying we cannot march anywhere.
A pretty good view of what happens most of the time in war. It's bloody, it's dirty, it's ugly, it's horrible.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, February 13th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Secretary of State Colin Powell is planning to confront France and Germany over their opposition to waging war against Iraq. According to the Washington Times, Powell will ask France and Germany if they're opposing the war in order to get President Saddam Hussein off the hook. This face-off will take place tomorrow at the UN when Chief Weapons Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei deliver their reports on searches that have not turned up what the Bush administration characterizes as hundreds of concealed and illicit biological or chemical weapons. Yesterday, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice made an unannounced visit to New York to pressure Blix about the language he would use in his report. On February 6, the citizens of Los Alamos, New Mexico, held their third and final town hall discussion on the impending war with Iraq and a resolution before the county council protesting that war. Los Alamos is most often remembered as the birthplace of the nuclear bomb, yet it is also a vibrant and culturally diverse intellectual community. The nuclear plant is still active, yet at this forum the focus was on peace. Peace Watch reporter Stephen Fettig brings us this sound from the event.
Is it appropriate for the county council to express a position regarding the contemplated war against Iraq?
Okay, I'm Jenny Crean. I have three quick things to say. The first one is that I absolutely think it's appropriate for county council to express their position. I read the resolution. I think that this is the position that they should express. I really like what this says. Second of all, if we had an election to decide this, I'm 16. I cannot vote. I could not make a decision about this. But 2 years from now, when I'm 18, this will still be affecting me. And so I think that having this and having the opportunity to express my opinion is very important, even though I'm not an adult citizen. And lastly, it doesn't matter whether 10% of the community is sent to Iraq or whether 1% of the community is sent to Iraq, because everybody is going to know someone who is sent there and probably someone who is killed there if we have this war. And that's still going to affect you. That's still going to hurt you, regardless of the number.
I'm Sig Gerstle. It's clearly, totally and utterly inappropriate for the county to even consider such a resolution. First of all, they have been elected, as it has been said before, to do the job for the county. Here, they are making an opinion. They are publishing an opinion as if it were the majority opinion of the citizens or of all the citizens. That's impossible. They cannot possibly know our opinion because they were simply elected for other reasons. Secondly, if you look at this resolution, I feel offended to even consider this because it talks about the citizens of Los Alamos, that we know more about such issues because we are Los Alamos. Of course, we are Los Alamos, and we have probably deeper insights into weapons of mass destruction, many of which have been designed and studied here much more than anywhere else. Here, this comes pretty close to admitting breach of security if you go about that.
I'm Chuck Pergler. I think we're faced with an extraordinary circumstance with a very short period of time, with a very pugnacious administration. My voice as an individual is not exactly silent, but it doesn't have the resonance that it would if this county council passes this sort of resolution. I think we do have a responsibility here to do it because this community has been a power for the past 50 years for keeping peace through strength. Again, it is our sons and daughters that will be affected by this. It is future generations. I think that is a community issue. This community, with a message of support for let the inspections work, will vibrate throughout this land, and we will make a difference.
Bill Beyer again. I favor the county council passing this resolution. Do you think if I wrote Senator Bingaman a letter, he would read it? I doubt it very much. Now, if the county council sends Bingaman a letter, I think he will notice it and read it. So the way we have the most power to affect our representatives is collectively rather than individually.
My name is Andrew Lauer, and I'm a student at LAHS. And I'd just like to start off by saying not only is it appropriate, but I feel it is necessary because we can barrage the senators and whatnot with letters. And like this man here said, you know, it's just going to be read by some third-rate person who's going to put tally marks next to our opinions. And if we can unite as a community and send a letter to our congressmen, then they'll read it. They'll understand that we as a community feel this way.
I'm Al Larson. I think it's imperative that this resolution be passed by the county. Government wants me to sit home and watch CNN and Fox and feel like I'm the only one that's crazy. Well, when I came out to the first meeting, there was like 200 people, and only eight of them were for the war. And I didn't feel like I was crazy anymore. There's somebody else besides me. And I think that the county council needs to take and pass this resolution to show that this at least there's a big segment that really doesn't believe the propaganda. The war aftermath will be a lot of dead Iraqis. I mean, the Afghan war, the estimate was like 3,500 innocent people killed. This business of precision bombing is not true. Innocent people get killed. It's going to be worse.
My name is Mark Boudelier. 11% of the proven reserves of oil on the planet are in Iraq. They have the second largest proven reserves of any nation on Earth. The largest consumer of oil on the planet is the United States of America, in excess of 26%. 60% of our oil is imported. Does anybody remember the reflagging of the Kuwaiti tankers under the Reagan administration? The shoot down of the Iran Air A-300 with 290 Iranians on board? And the subsequent blasting of the sky over Lockerbie of Pan Am 103. You're damn right this is about oil. Now, as to the resolution before the council, which is what this is about, we've been cut off from our democracy by campaign finance. Large corporations. Today I went to the fec.gov.org. I invite you all to do the same. Look at who financed George Bush's campaign. They're his bosses. They're his masters. I can't get my senator on the phone. Kenneth Lake could at Enron. So how do we reach him? How do we get the word out? Well, this community, Los Alamos, New Mexico, the birthplace of nuclear weapons, our voice would ring through Congress, would echo off the walls if we sent this resolution. Who are the town councilmen? Are they present tonight? I would urge you, gentlemen, to pass this resolution. It's the only way I have of reaching my representatives. It's the only thing they're going to listen to.
I just wanted to make a clarifying remark. The gist of the thing that the council is being asked to say is not whether or not to go to war. It's whether or not to go to war if the UN goes along with us. It's one thing to go it alone. It's another thing to go in with people who are our equals in worrying about the world. And so I think we haven't even addressed that. And, you know, what I hear from a lot of people is, oh, you know, the UN, you can't do anything with the UN. George Bush Sr. did plenty with the UN. The UN is our way of seeing if our airtight logic is wrong. You can always set up the argument so that the logic is so compelling you can't get out of it. You're just rattling around inside of it, and somebody just stands outside and says, that's not it. And until we can convince the UN, or 99% of it, there's always somebody, but until we can convince the UN to do it, we should take as a guiding principle, we ain't got it right. The UN has got to be there. Think of a country, a world without it.
My name is Jake Turin. I'm a newcomer. I've only been working up here about 11 years. I think the events of the last few years have shown us that to kill a whole bunch of people doesn't take a Manhattan Project anymore. You can do it with a bio lab. You can do it with stuff you can buy over the internet. You can do it with box cutters on a plane. In that sort of a world where dangers can lurk anywhere, we can't look for safety with a single policeman. My belief is that the only hope for safety and security in that sort of a scary world is a system of legal safeguards and a world community where people can work together to share intelligence information, to share strategies against individual terrorist organizations. And one loose cannon country going out there and saying, hey, I can handle this on my own and I can do whatever I need to do. After 9/11, that's what the United States did. And what did that have the immediate effect of? Suddenly, India said, oh, open season on terrorists. I can go invade Pakistan. The Israeli government said, hey, whatever it takes, if you want to blame terrorists, we can do it now. The United States says it's okay, so we can do it. And the United States, which should be and has been in the past a beacon of democracy, an example for the rest of the world, by throwing all that down the drain and saying, hey, we don't care what anyone else thinks and it's up to us to decide that might makes right, that's going to hurt all of us. And when I say all of us, I mean Americans, Europeans, Africans, Asians, all of us.
I'm Dale Holm. I've been around here for a little over 50 years. I thought that our Secretary of State made a very good presentation. And if his facts were correct, then he made logical conclusions. But I was in the intelligence community here for about 8 to 10 years, and I know from firsthand experience that you can get data that look very convincing and are very wrong. And so the British have gone on record as saying that they see no tie between Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi regime. And so I just throw that out as a data point. My concerns are that the outcome of this will not make the world safer at all. And what I wouldn't be a teeny weeny bit surprised is that the destabilization that is likely to occur following this may bring the whole house of cards of our buddies on down, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and perhaps even Iran.
Okay, I'm Lindsay Sullivan. I go to Los Alamos High School. I don't know, talking about this world being a safe place is especially important to me because I still have so much of my life ahead of me, and it's my generation who's going to be going off and fighting this war if it does indeed happen. And I think that it's really important to consider the things that Saddam has done in the past. He has not proven himself to be at all truthful, and we're just giving him more time to, you know, build up whatever he's doing.
It would be nice if we had a world in which legal safeguards and weapons inspections could keep us safe. Saddam Hussein is a case in point that world does not exist. The United Nations is a case in point that world does not exist. As John pointed out, it was a ceasefire that ended the first Gulf War and not a peace treaty. And the ceasefire stipulated explicitly that Saddam Hussein was to disarm. And of course, as we know, that did not happen. And going back a little bit in time to history as well, you may recall that Germany after World War I was expected to disarm. Exactly the same thing happened then. Weapons inspections, legal safeguards, that does not keep us safe in this world.
My name is John McLeod. In America, history is largely ignored. At best, it's a trivial pursuit. At worst, it gets accused of being lies your teacher told you to brainwash you on something or other. Most of the world isn't like that. How many of you remember in your high school textbooks some lesson about Mesopotamia, the cradle of civilization? We call it Iraq today. That's where we're going, where the history is laid layer upon layer, 60 centuries deep. And it's not a trivial pursuit there. Now, I don't have to go back 60 centuries to make the case I want to make. I only have to go back 8 or 9. These people still remember the Crusades. They are going to react, and all of Islam is going to react to an invasion that is entirely non-Islamic. Even European allies are not going to help us. I have not the slightest doubt that the United States Army and Air Force can control the skies and the desert almost instantly. But if we send our troops into the great central metropolis of Islam, Baghdad, where the caliphs used to sit, with all European Christians, or people that look that way to Islam, we're going to have 1 billion Muslims all over the world up in arms against us. Someday, I think the day will come when the world calls upon us to provide the mighty arm of air cover for an Islamic police force that can wear their religion on their sleeves to go into Baghdad and find the bio labs in their cellars.
My name is Jenny Crean, and I'm a student at the high school. And I would just like to say I agree with what the last person said, because those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. And I think looking back over the last 100 years of world history, there have been so many conflicts. And I think especially with World War I, after September 11th, there were a lot of people who said, we need to find out who did this, and we need to hold them accountable. And I agree with that. You can't let people get away with horrible things like that. But if you take it too far, I mean, after World War I, a lot of the European nations were so bent on holding Germany accountable for what they had done that it set the world up for the Second World War. And I'd just like to say that if we lose sight of the bigger picture, and if we get so wrapped up in what we're doing that we take this too far, then we're just going to set ourselves up for more problems.
I'm Carmen Hill, and I don't know if I'm pro-war or if I'm against war, but I know that when I went to Denver and saw my boyfriend, and he held me, and he just cried because his best friend had been sent to Iraq, and he sobbed, and he felt so guilty because he wasn't there to save his friend, that all I could feel in my heart was that this was so wrong, that this has to affect so many people on more than just a political level, but on an emotional level as well, because when I looked into his big brown eyes and they filled up with tears, you have to think about the people who will be fighting for your country, not just what you believe in.
Citizens of Los Alamos, New Mexico, discussing their concerns about a potential war with Iraq. The county council voted 6-1 against an anti-war resolution earlier this week. The organizers of the town hall meeting were disappointed, but consider it a victory to have even convinced the conservative county council to consider the resolution. The verdict is in on whether anti-war protesters will be allowed to march to the United Nations Saturday during a massive peace rally scheduled for the weekend. United for Peace and Justice spokesperson Leslie Kaufman says their request was denied.
We were appealing the decision by federal judge Barbara Jones that said that the New York Police Department can deny us a permit to march on February 15th. The appeals court upheld that decision. However, we really want to emphasize that we do have a legal permit to rally, and the protest is very much still on. We expect it to be massive on First Avenue, stretching north from 49th Street. The appeals court ruled that the lower court's decision was not a violation of our First Amendment rights. We find that a rather outrageous finding, to say the least. We've said all along that we were very flexible. We want to march past the UN, but we understand that there are security considerations. We were completely open to negotiating other march routes, but the NYPD and the courts are saying we cannot march anywhere.
Up to 10 million people on 5 continents are expected to demonstrate against the probable war in Iraq on Saturday in some of the largest peace marches ever known. Yesterday, up to 400 cities in 60 countries from Antarctica to the Pacific Islands confirmed peace rallies, vigils, and marches would take place. The U.S. bombing campaign over the so-called no-fly zones over Iraqi airspace continued this week. This time, it was on the heels of a visit to Baghdad by historian William R. Polk, former State Department official under the Kennedy administration. Upon his return to the States, Polk held an informal press briefing in Washington, D.C., to which Peace Watch producer Reem Kathuda was among the invitees.
An urgent call from Nizar Jawdat, the owner of St. Luke's Gallery and the co-founder of the New Iraqi Americans for Peaceful Alternatives, inviting us to cover the visit of his friend and, quote, Middle East expert, William Polk, who just came back from Baghdad, got me hurrying. The former professor of history and director of the Middle Eastern Studies Center of the University of Chicago is living in France nowadays, so this was a unique opportunity. The briefing was being held in the gallery, in a beautiful house in Washington, D.C. Surrounded by some 17 journalists and David Roberts' peaceful lithographic renderings of the Holy Land and Egypt, stood William Polk. He spoke softly, sharing his recent one-week trip and some of his experiences in the region. He spoke for a while.
The striking things about being in Baghdad, people are going about their daily lives, and they don't seem to be frightened. The social workers and doctors and so forth have reported there's a great upsurge of the taking of tranquilizers, particularly among children, that there's a great quiet or subliminal fear. But you don't notice this very much. People seem to be going about their lives. I think one of the mistakes that's been made is to ascribe this to some kind of notion of Oriental or Islamic fatalism. I don't think that's an element at all in it. Iraq, first of all, is a very secular country. To call somebody a mutasadafin, a religious fundamentalist person who's going back into the old times, is very insulting. To call somebody a Wahhabi is really like saying he's a country bumpkin. There is no particular feeling that I could identify of any overwhelming social or political result of Islam. The government is certainly opposed to Osama bin Laden and all the people like him. And you may remember that in the 1991 war, Osama bin Laden offered to create a brigade to engage in throwing the Iraqis out of Kuwait. There's no love at all between the religious fundamentalist and Islam and this regime. But why don't people fear more? You walk around, you don't see sandbags piled up in front of doorways. You don't see people digging slit trenches or anything like that. I talked to a lot of people and I said, are you stockpiling food? And various people would say, yes, I have some dried beans and rice and so forth in the sirdab in the cellar of my house. And I said, what about water? That's the critical thing. No, they said, you know, water's really too expensive. And my children would drink it all within a week, and we'd run through everything that I had. And I first thought how short-sighted and silly, and I started at one point to actually argue with one of the people who'd said this. And then I remembered my own time in our government when I was a member of the sort of second tier of the Cuba Missile Crisis time. And I, at one point, when President Kennedy decided to board the Russian ships, I was just on the point of calling my wife and telling her to get the children out of Washington. And then I thought, why? Where are they going to go? What's going to happen? You know, if hell comes to the earth, what difference is it really going to make? And I think that finally is the thing that one feels in Baghdad. And then you think, well, how do people protect themselves psychologically about this? And it seems to me that what it came down to was that everybody was focused on, I get up in the morning and I get dressed and I've got to put my shoes on and I've got to have breakfast and then I've got to get the car out and there's a traffic jam and what time am I going to get to the office and I've got to do these various things that I do. And I, you know, the day-to-day minutia that in a way really keeps all of us alive all the time. And you think, these people think, well, okay, probably something bad's going to happen, probably, but I don't know when. That's sort of tomorrow or the next day or whatever. And I thought, trying to understand this again, I thought when my mother was dying of cancer, she had decided a long time before that she was never going to allow that to happen, that all the terrible things that happened to a person with cancer, she was going to take some sleeping pills and get it all over with. And her older sister, who was living with her at the time, every night would put out a bottle of sleeping pills. And Mother would close the bottle and put them back on the shelf. And I never had a chance to ask her, but since that time I've thought about it and talked to various other people. There's always, well, it's now Tuesday. So-and-so's coming to see me on Thursday, so I'll take the sleeping pills on Friday. And then Friday comes, and then there's Monday, and there's the next thing. And I think that's something that probably fits all of our lives in a very fundamental sense, that each of us says, well, I've got to right now do this, and I'll do the next thing when it comes around to be the time. And it wasn't fatalism. After all, the Iraqis have lived through 10 years of really a very grueling war, and then another 10 years of the sanctions program in which thousands of children have died. And they really have actually experienced, almost uniquely in the world, nuclear war. During the Gulf War, we fired some 300 tons of depleted uranium shells, uranium-233 or 235, I've forgotten which one, and they, as a result, have enormous numbers of people who've had cancer from that, and thousands of children born with birth defects. And each artillery shell had 3,500 grams of uranium in it. And nobody in Baghdad can be said not to know what war is like. But I didn't find anybody who said he wanted to leave or who was going to leave. And it wasn't just the people I talked to in the government. It was everybody from the street sweepers all the way up. Nobody's going to leave. Everybody said almost the same thing. I was born here. This is my land. And I said to one man, have you thought about, say, going to another town? Because everybody was reading the Western press, and they'd all said, there are going to be 300 or 500 or however many cruise missiles coming in and blowing the whole city up. Have you thought about leaving and going to another city? And they said, where am I going to get any food for my children? Where am I going to get a roof over my head? How am I going to possibly exist? The main aspect of the mood is just one of tension. The interesting thing is the contrast. You look at the people in the White House and around the Defense Department, practically none of them have ever seen what war really is. I've been shot at and I've been bombed, and I won't say like the president did that he'd been to war, but everybody in Baghdad knows what it is. And it's horrible. When somebody's in combat and he's hit by a bullet, he's blown halfway across the room. He defecates, he urinates in his trousers. It's ugly, and big green flies landing on the dead bodies. One person's legs blown off and arms partially blown off, lying dead on his daughter's breast. I've seen people blown to pieces in war. It's an ugly, horrible, terrible thing. And there ought to be a law requiring everybody to see the first 10 minutes of the movie Finding Private Ryan. That's a pretty good view of what happens most of the time in war. It's bloody, it's dirty, it's ugly, it's horrible.
I looked around me to the mesmerized journalists. William Polk words had brought tears to their eyes, and the British writer for the Financial Times wiped her eyes. Tomorrow, we'll bring you William Polk's conversation with Tariq Aziz and some of his comments on Bush's administration's foreign policy and patriotism. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW, Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Katkhuda.
That was the first in a two-part series. The second segment will air tomorrow on Peace Watch. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.